I'm in for Saturday, I tell him. This is not how I pictured Ashley's monthly poker night. For one thing, the man who answers the door to the bi-level 5 miles outside town isn't a stranger. He's a 70-something-year-old dead ringer for Morgan Freeman, as long as you ignore the full Red Wings-branded sweatsuit and matching slippers, which don't strike me as a particularly Freeman-esque sartorial choice.
About time you showed up,
he greets us and steps aside to let us into his home. Harvey, I say, too stunned to move. Sorry we're late. Ashley tips her head toward me. Daphne's fault, obviously. Harvey snorts.
I know I've got a youthful glow, but I wasn't born yesterday. Come in, come in. Shoes off. Everyone's back in the breakfast nook.
I slip my loafers off next to Ashley's knee-high boots, and we follow Harvey down a narrow, wood-paneled wall toward the sound of smooth jazz and the potent smell of cigar smoke. Every inch of the walls is devoted to at least 3 generations of family photos, ranging from recent shots of his granddaughter's soccer tournaments all the way back to time-faded wedding portraits of him and his late wife. So how long has this poker night been going on? I ask.
Literally since I was born, Ashley says. But I wasn't allowed to join until I was 18.
You've known each other that long? I say, surprised. They're friendly at work, but I've never once gotten the sense that they actually know each other.
Since she was 2 feet tall, Harvey tells me now.
So, 8th grade, I say, and he hacks out a laugh.
Harvey has this whole thing about not showing favoritism at work. Ashley makes finger quotes. He even made the district manager do my job interview rather than just hiring me.
Wouldn't you hate wondering whether you'd really deserved it or not? He asks.
Not really, no, she says.
Harvey moves out of the hallway so we can slide into the breakfast nook after him.
Look who decided to finally show up, he says. And she brought us a new 5th.
Trial basis only, Ashley says. We'll see if she can hold her own. This is Daphne. Daphne, this is
Lenore, I say, shocked anew to spot tall, gangly Lenore from the asparagus stand tucked back in the chair closest to the room's bay window. And right beside her, the final participant in poker night, tiny and dark-haired, Barb. They're both wearing the same visors as when I met them. Both have matching cigars hanging out of their mouths. Lenore yanks hers out from between her lips as she stands to greet me.
What a nice surprise.
Ashley looks between us.
You know each other?
We've met, I say, right as Barb chimes in.
She's our friend Miles's new girl.
Small towns.
How do you know Miles?
Ashley asks, right as I say, oh, we're just friends. Right as Harvey says,
who the hell is Miles?
And sinks into one of the cane-backed dining chairs. It's the first time I've ever heard Harvey swear. Still less shocking than the Red Wings slippers. Lenore asks Ashley,
how do you two know each other?
Daphne works with us at the library, Ashley replies.
Who's this Miles fellow?
Harvey says. Miles is my roommate, I clarify, at which Lenore and Barb exchange a knowing look. Ashley slings her huge purse onto the floor and drops into the chair beside Harvey, leaving me to take the one next to Barb. Harvey plucks a cigar from a small wooden box in the center of the laminate table, then slides the box toward us.
No thanks, I say.
Ashley pops one right out, reaching for the cigar cutter in the box's lid.
So how do all of you know each other? I ask.
Harvey starts to shuffle.
Oh, we all go way back.
Grace Episcopal.
Lenore nods like, you understand. I don't.
My mom was the priest there, Ashley explains. My stepmom, technically, but my dad died when I was tiny and my mom married Adaro when I was 6, so she was a parent to me for basically as long as I can remember.
A sadness flutters through the room. Harvey sets his hand atop Ashley's and gives it a squeeze.
She was a good woman.
The best.
Lenore exhales a perfect ring of smoke toward the open bay window.
Great poker player, too.
Before I can ask, or decide if I should, Ashley says curtly, stomach cancer, 5.5 years ago.
I think of my own mother and feel like my chest might crumble. I'm so sorry. I had no idea. It's hard. She cups a hand around her cigar as she lights it. When we lost Adara, Mom really needed to be somewhere new, so she moved out to Sedona, where her sister lives. Mulder and I miss both of them a lot, but at least without Mom and Adara in the game undercutting me, I can finally take these geezers for all they're worth. Lenore scoffs.
Good luck.
She taught me everything she knew, Ashley says, hands up, cigar dangling from the corner of her mouth like a Hunter S. Thompson character. I'm the heir apparent here.
Would have been, Barb replies, if you'd been the kind of kid who listens to a damn word your elders say.
They ooh, they ah, they trash talk, they keep accusing each other of putting off the inevitable until finally we play the first round. I quickly fold, nothing but a pair of twos in my hand. Harvey celebrates his winning royal flush by shuffling into the kitchen and coming back with a bottle of nice scotch. He pours a little for each of us, and Barb puts a new record on.
Round two,
Lenore says, rubbing her hands together. By the end of the night, I've lost $40, won 11 of it back, smoked my first cigar, and promised to go to Harvey's 75th birthday party, which isn't until October, 3.5 months from now, but for which planning has already commenced.
We're going to rent a party bus and go down to the casino,
Barb tells me, eyes sparkling from laughing, drinking, smoking, and soundly kicking our asses at the card table.
Assuming I don't kick the bucket before then,
Harvey says.
Oh no, we'll still rent the party bus,
Lenore puts in.
It'll just be a funeral instead of a birthday.
Going out in style,
Harvey says. Should we make sure you're wearing your signature look? I ask, gesturing toward his getup. As soon as I've said it, I feel that familiar, oh shit, dip in my stomach, unsure whether the joke crossed an invisible line. But Harvey's coughing out a laugh, along with a cloud of smoke.
You can come back,
Harvey tells me. Then to Ashley, pointedly,
bring her back.
Then to me again,
just don't expect special treatment at work.
I cross my heart. At the front door, we all exchange hugs farewell. Then Ashley and I slip on our shoes and step out into the quiet cul-de-sac. Most of the other houses are either totally dark or have one lone bulb glowing beside their front doors, but if Ashley is to be believed, poker night is just getting started.
Share a cab?
She asks, swaying slightly on the spot as she summons one on her phone. Neither of us is fit to drive.
First a hobby, then a cab, I say. What's next?
A deadly secret, Ashley deadpans. At least, I think it's a joke.
That was really fun, I say. I haven't been to a party since,
I think for a moment.
My engagement party, I guess.
You thought that was a party? She says.
We really do need to get you out more. I shrug. I've always been kind of a tag-along, I guess. Only lately I haven't had anyone to tag along after.
You're not a tag-along, she says. You're a wee girl.
Like a wee lass, I ask.
No, like, we love that restaurant. We always vacation there. We don't really like scary movies. A woman who's more comfortable being a part of a whole who never goes anywhere without a partner.
Shit, I say. You're right. Of course I'm right, she says. I'm wise.
The first we was my mom and me. Then it was Sadie and me. Then Peter. I've always cleaved to the people I love, tried to orient my orbit around them. Maybe, I realize, I've been trying to make myself unleavable. But it hasn't worked.
I don't want to just be a part of we, I say. I want to be an I.
You're already an I. It's just about how much you embrace it.
I guess, I say.
Ashley appraises me.
You held your own tonight.
Yeah, well, I have a feeling they went easy on me, I say.
Oh, they treated you like you were made of glass.
She agrees, her head cocked and gaze appraising.
But you're not so delicate, Vincent.
I'm not. It feels true, at least right now. I'm not so delicate. Lonely, hurt, angry, a little bit whiny, sure. But not delicate. Maybe I could handle staying here, where my life fell apart.
Maybe I could start over, making something my own this time. The cab pulls up. Ashley, I say.
Hmm?
She says. Thank you, I say. Really? She rolls her eyes. We needed a fifth. I shake my head. Not just that. For being my friend. For still giving me a chance after the last year. Her ever blunt features soften. You know, she says, I needed one too. I'm glad it could be me, I tell her. Right back at you. The cab driver flashes his lights at us, and with our arms slung over each other's shoulders, we wobble down the driveway to meet him. For reasons I don't completely understand, I feel like I could cry. 17. Saturday, June 29th, 49 days until I can leave. Why don't you just tell me? I ask Miles as I follow him into the kitchen.
Because, he says, opening the fridge, you already agreed to go.
And you're afraid I'll back out once I know what it is? I ask. He pulls the water pitcher out, fills his glass, and drinks the whole thing while smirking at me. Come on, Miles, I say. I hate surprises.
Then you should have asked questions before you said you'd go with me, he says.
Are we skydiving? I ask. He refills the pitcher at the sink.
I doubt it.
Does what we're doing involve heavy manual labor? I ask. He puts the pitcher back in the fridge.
Go put on something nice, Daphne. We have to leave soon.
He squeezes past me to leave the kitchen. Funeral? I call after him. He pauses and looks back at me.
Closer.
Please tell me that's a joke, I say. His smirk splits into a grin.
You can wear red if that's what you're asking.
A funeral for someone you hate? I say. He laughs and ducks away.
Be ready in half an hour,
he says, somewhere out of view. In my bedroom, I put on the only really nice dress I have, the same backless black one I wore to my engagement party and to Cherry Hill with Ashley that first night. She and Julia are out at a local jazz club tonight, so I message them in a group chat. Do either of you know where Miles and I are going? Julia writes, he still hasn't told you? Ashley says, laughing my ass off, yes I do. I send a bunch of question marks. Julia says, oh my God, she just told me. What is it? I ask. Ashley only replies with a winky face. Julia adds, take lots of pics, please. Senior prom, reads the silver banner. It's strung between the two columns that frame the baby pink beachside resort's front doors, a bouquet of black and silver balloons on either side of it. Miles's truck rumbles to a stop in front of them. What? I say.
Don't worry.
Miles puts the car in park.
It's going to get a lot weirder.
A teenage valet comes sprinting out of the hotel, and Miles gets out of the truck to hand over his car keys. I follow suit, and he meets me at the front door. It's the middle of the summer, I say.
June 29th, he agrees.
We're like 35 years old, I point out next.
Yes, we are,
Miles says. How are we at a senior prom? I ask.
How are any of us anywhere? He teases. Come on.
He sets a hand against the small of my back, a tingle leaping up my vertebrae as I let the light touch guide me into the hotel's opulent lobby. Glossy tiled floors topped with thick floral rugs and boldly clashing geometric wallpaper, velvet chairs arranged in seating areas on either side of us, and a mounted sign straight ahead. Waning Bay Historical Society, Senior Prom. The arrow beneath it points left. I glance at Miles, who looks delighted by my utter bafflement. He grabs my hand and leads me down the carpeted hallway, music swelling as we reach the propped open double doors at the end. We step through and pass beneath an arch of silver balloons into a ballroom bedecked in shimmering streamers and balloons filled with glitter. White cloth tables topped with plump bouquets of white roses ring a glossy dance floor.
beyond which a row of back doors sit open onto a veranda limned in twinkling lights, couples already standing around the high-top tables out there, chatting, with cocktails in hand. That's when I finally notice the guests themselves, all extravagantly dressed, some nearby extravagantly perfumed, most with one obvious trait in common. Oh my God. I spin toward Miles and drop my voice. What is this?
It's a senior prom, he says, grinning down at me.
Senior, here, has a different connotation entirely. We're probably one of three couples here who don't remember the day of the first lunar landing. He scoops two champagne flutes off the silver tray of a passing cater waiter.
This will help with the shock,
Miles says, lifting one of the champagne flutes up to my lips. I just barely manage to swallow my mouthful of wine instead of spewing it. Please, I say, explain this to me like I'm new to the planet.
You're newish to Waning Bay, he says, so the effect's the same.
What school is this for? I ask.
No school, he says. It's a fundraiser the Historical Society does every year. Tons of business owners here. I thought it could be a good place for you to meet sponsors, for the readathon.
I'm so weirdly touched by this that my whole body feels about 20 degrees warmer than it did a second ago. Then again, that could be the wine I just chugged. That's sweet, I tell him. But it doesn't explain why you're here. You already had these tickets.
Well, first of all,
he leans in close, drops his voice to a whisper against my ear.
I love old people.
I have noticed you tend to do well with the over 70 set, I allow. Then again, you're not so bad with the under 70 set. He rolls his eyes, but he's smiling.
I guess it's nice being around people who've made it through shit, you know?
He shrugs.
Like, probably all their worst mistakes are behind them, and they know who they are now and how to be who they want to be.
I feel my smile falling, my heart softening. There's something wistful in his voice, and I'm not used to wistful Miles.
Plus, he says, brightening, Lenore is on the board for the society, and she badgered me into doing my part and buying a couple seats.
He touches my back, tipping his chin toward the mahogany bar across the ballroom.
Here, let's get a real drink.
As we make our way over and join the back of the mercifully short line, something dawns on me. You said first of all. Miles' brow wrinkles.
What?
You said first of all you love, I silently mouth, old people so no one in line will hear it. But you didn't buy two tickets for this just because of... I trail off as it hits me. Well, partly I trail off because it hits me. Mostly I trail off because at the exact same time that it occurs to me why Miles might have two tickets to this event, the second reason why happens to walk through the balloon arch. Blonde, willowy, looking spectacular in seafoam green, with one hand delicately crooked in the arm of her equally spectacular tux-wearing date. Miles and I look at each other, mirroring each other's shock and horror, an endless loop of, oh God, anything but this.
I assumed she wouldn't come,
Miles spits out. Uh-huh, is all I can manage. My brain is busy planning escape routes. With Peter and Petra still standing just inside the doorway, our best bet would be to sprint out onto the veranda, pitch ourselves over the railing, and belly flop hard onto the sandy beach below.
I'm the one who bought the tickets, Miles is saying. So I just assumed she wouldn't come.
What do we do? I ask him.
I mean, Miles says, we could say hi, or just ignore them. It's a big room.
Suddenly, the entire state of Michigan doesn't feel large enough for all four of us. I glance back to the doors. Peter and Petra have moved off along the wall, serpentining through the tables toward a group of people in the back corner.
Granny Comer's here.
Miles grunts. Granny Comer? I repeat, aghast.
Petra's grandmother,
he helpfully supplies. No, I gathered that. I just can't believe that's what they call her. Do they secretly hate her?
No, they love her, he says. It's me they secretly hated.
So they have just as bad taste as Petra, then. I bite out. He smiles, but it's quick.
there, then gone.
Do you want to run?
Obviously, I do. But I'm also thinking about the picture of Peter and Petra with Sadie and Cooper, about all those sacred places in Richmond that don't belong to me anymore, about the house that wasn't ever really mine, and about Petra bringing Peter here, even knowing Miles already had tickets. Ma'am? The bartender calls toward us. We've made it to the front of the line. She's waiting for us to order. I lock eyes with Miles.
If you need to, we can run,
he says.
But
his head tips, eyes glimmering beneath his dark lashes. But, I say.
We could also stay,
Miles replies.
Drink, dance,
have fun. In a room with our exes, I point out, who think we're dating. Miles' smile hitches up.
See, he says, doesn't that sound fun?
Ma'am,
the bartender says more loudly this time. We shouldn't have to leave. If they're uncomfortable, they can go. I turn back to her. Two shots of whiskey, please. 18. As usual, Miles knows everyone. From the time we realize there's a banquet table covered in desserts out on the veranda and start toward it, we can't make it further than 2 yards at a time without being waylaid by another white-haired or gray-bearded Miles Nowick superfan. My stomach is just empty enough to let the whiskey shot do the socializing, which is for the best, because when Lance, the hobby shop owner, answers Miles's questions about how business is going, so-so, kids these days don't like building like they used to, Miles neatly pivots with,
I bet the library kids would love it. Have you thought about donating some DIY kits to the readathon?
To which, of course, Lance replies,
what's a readathon?
And Miles very gently nudges me forward, angling himself toward me with a little reassuring nod. Ordinarily, I'd rather shave my legs with a broken beer bottle than give an impromptu verbal pitch, but he's teed me up so nicely, and I'm already in a ballroom with my ex-fiancé, so what's the worst that could happen? It's a fundraiser, I tell him. And when I'm done telling him about the fundraiser, I find myself talking about the kids, about the staff, about our desperate need for an updated stock of kid lit, and by the end of our conversation, Lance has not only pledged 10 kite-building sets for prizes, but also offered to host a miniature painting class for us in the fall. By the time we actually make it to the dessert table, I've also met Miles's favorite cheesemonger, the owner of Cherry City Cherry Goods, Molly of Molly's Popcorn Emporium fame, and the guy who runs the walk-up ice cream place Frosty Dips. I've also had an exceptionally brief conversation with Barb and Lenore, right before a volunteer ran up requiring their assistance, breaking up some necking in the indoor pool room. In the last hour, the readathon has racked up a free charcuterie board for its volunteers, 100 gift bags of chocolate-covered cherries, an assortment of popcorn, and one large, tax-free cash donation. I, meanwhile, have accumulated a surplus of both awe and hunger. As Miles and I hover over the dessert table, loading a shared plate up with cookies and cake slices and individual cups of chocolate ganache, I say, still half-dazed, I don't understand how you just did that. He hands me a pink macaron, which I put directly into my mouth.
I didn't do anything, he says. People care about what you're doing.
Maybe, I say, mouth full. But I've been trying to get a hold of someone from Frosty Dips for a while.
Well, Dillard from Frosty Dips' brother runs the hardware store / barbershop I go to,
Miles says. I've been here long enough to just accept that sentence, I say. I also emailed Popcorn Emporium back in March. Miles frowns at that, adds a light golden macaron to the plate.
I know this sucks, but sometimes people need to put a face on something before they're willing to help. An email doesn't do that.
Thank you for being the face, I say. He turns toward me.
You made them care, not me.
Well, I think my being the fake girlfriend of the mayor of Waning Bay didn't hurt, so thanks. Really. He turns toward me, smiling through the twinkling lights, and taps a lime green macaron in between my lips.
Anytime,
he says. I manage not to moan, but it still feels too intimate. The veranda is almost entirely abandoned and darker than the ballroom, and despite the breeze, I feel flushed. I clear my throat. Should we go inside?
If you want, he hums.
Let's do it, I say, and start forward. But in choosing whether to stay out here in the electric dark alone with him or go back into a crowded room, I forgot to calculate for one important variable. The one we nearly run smack into as soon as we get inside. Petra's aquamarine eyes flare for a millisecond before her expression melts into a warm smile and a throaty, femme fatale purr of, "Oh my God, it's so good to see you guys." To which I say nothing, largely because she's already wrapped me in a hug that smells like sandalwood, a glossy curtain of blonde completely obscuring my vision until she pulls away. She goes for Miles next, doesn't hurl herself at him like she did me, but instead draws up onto her tiptoes and squeezes him to her. One of his arms comes up across her back, his other hand setting the dessert plate down on the table next to us. He manages his own even "you two" to her, and I wish for the floor to open up and swallow me whole, or the booze to knock me out cold.
"You look beautiful," Petra says, squeezing my forearm.
"Thanks," I force out. "You too."
"I love this dress," she says. "It's so different. Your usual style is so buttoned up."
Ouch. Miles touches my back, his hand skimming over to my far hip, pulling me into his side.
"Like a secret," he says.
I look up at him, the gratitude in my upper abdomen giving way to an ache, a want.
"Or a librarian," Peter adds tartly.
And even though I'm 90% sure he didn't mean this as a dig at me, the wind still leaves my sails at being reminded of the disparity between me and the woman both men present have loved. Miles's hand slides forward from my hip around my stomach, drawing me into him so that my back is pressed to his front.
"Yeah, I've always had a thing about that," he says.
"About what?"
Petra says.
"Hot librarians,"
he says, looking down at me with a faint grin that hits my heart like the first shock of a defibrillator.
"What about you, Daphne?" Peter says.
I flinch, look back at him. I don't know if they realize they're doing it, but Peter and Petra have drawn closer too, like this is some competitive dirty dancing situation. He's got an arm hooked around her waist, and she's set a hand proprietarily on his chest.
"You've been harboring a secret bartender fantasy?"
Peter asks dryly. And once again, I'm mostly sure he's not trying to be a dick to me, but I'm also sure he does mean to be a dick to Miles. Judging from Petra's gaping mouth and tight brow, she thinks so too. And then there's Miles, who I feel tense behind me, even though he's still smiling, one hand still gently rubbing over my hip bone like he's not bothered at all. I am. I'm bothered. "No," I say firmly, turning in to Miles. I loop my own arms around his waist, basically propping my boobs up on his chest and gazing into his eyes as I say,
"But the roommate thing is pretty hot."
Miles's pupils flare as he takes the cue, one hand cupping my jaw, and kisses me. And I've kissed Miles in front of Peter before, a kiss that was a move in a game. But this feels different. This one is the prize. Slow, soft, familiar, a relief of a kiss, and over way, way too soon. Though from the way Petra is gawking at us, you'd think we'd just performed a handstanding 69 in front of God and everyone. Miles knots his hand through mine, his knuckles tightening as he clears his throat.
"Excuse us,"
he says.
"I've been waiting all week to dance with Daphne."
He tugs me away from them, and I follow, brain foggy, but heart racing as it all replays. The light, upward brush of his lips, the pressure of his tongue, the way his hand rolled back and forth across my hip bone while his other tilted my jaw to the perfect angle. We draw to a stop near the center of the dance floor, the twinkling lights seeming to shimmer and dance across his face as the mirror ball twirls over us.
"You okay?"
he asks.
Yeah, good,
I say, voice small.
Good,
he says, and folds his fingers through mine again, drawing me in, already slightly swaying along to Neil Young's Harvest Moon. He sets his other hand against my back, every motion so slow, so considered, every second engraving itself into my memory.
I'm sorry,
I say. His brow furrows.
For what Peter said.
Ah.
His shoulder twitches toward a shrug.
It's fine.
It's not,
I say.
It's nothing I didn't hear from Petra's family for the last 3 years,
he replies. My hand involuntarily clenches into the fabric of his shirt, like that will do any good, protect him from anyone who doesn't understand what kind of gift he is.
I thought you said they were nice, I say.
No, they were.
Another shrug, a sidelong dart of his eyes before they drop.
Every once in a while, though, there were comments. Must be nice not to have to grow up. Things like that.
Miles, that's not nice.
She always thought I was reading too much into it, he says. But I think they were worried I couldn't give Petra everything they want for her.
Then they're not only mean, they're also stupid.
They had a point, he says. I've never been good under pressure. I would have fucked it up eventually.
Based on what? I demand.
His smile is rueful.
History.
For several seconds, neither of us speaks. We just slowly sway and turn with the music.
Thank you, by the way, he murmurs, for what you said to Peter.
It takes me a second to remember what I said, and then the lava starts coursing through my face.
Sorry about that.
Miles laughs.
No, don't be embarrassed.
He touches my cheek for a second, then feels my blush with the backs of his fingers.
It was amazing. I think Peter's soul left his body for a second.
The flirty, nervous buzz in my chest dies at the mention of Peter. I know I've been a willing participant in this whole game, but the closer I get to Miles, the harder it is to tell what's real.
Well, what's embarrassing about copping to a roommate sex fantasy right after your ex's hot fiancé calls you dowdy?
She did not call you dowdy,
Miles says. He twirls me, pulls me back in closer, our bodies fitting snugly together, every point of friction its own little sun, heat and gravity and heat and gravity. Defend her all you want, Miles.
I'm not defending her, he says. I know she didn't say that because there's no way she thinks that. I mean, obviously, you're...
His eyes cascade down me. It's fine, I promise. I'm fine with how I look, except when I have to stand next to my ex's super hot girlfriend and really underscore the trade-up. Miles stops moving abruptly.
Don't say that.
It's true, I say. Something better always comes along. That's my curse.
Daphne.
He gives a low, scraping laugh, but his eyes stay serious.
You can't see him right now, but Peter is literally standing in a gap at the edge of the dance floor, watching your every move, and in a second, I'm going to turn you 90 degrees and kiss you again, and when I stop, I want you to look to your left and see his face. Then you can tell me if he thinks his new life, without you, is something better.
And as soon as he says the last word, he does it. Moves us in a half turn, drops his nose along mine, and it's like we picked up where the last kiss left off, everything already more urgent, intense from the jump. And I'm not wondering what Peter thinks of all this when Miles parts my lips with his tongue, his hand sliding firmly down to the curve of my ass. And when Miles's other hand winds itself into my hair and my spine arches up into him of its own accord, I'm thinking only of the spicy scent of ginger, the taste of espresso macaron in his mouth, the feeling of his erection between us. For a few seconds, I'm nothing but a body seeking more of his. I only regain awareness when a couple of old ladies in beaded mother-of-the-bride type sets start hooting and clapping for us at a nearby table. Miles touches my chin with his thumb as he sweeps one last kiss over my mouth. He straightens up.
Look left,
he says scratchily. But I don't. Instead, I step back. Then I turn and run. 19.
I plan to dart into a bathroom and catch my breath, convince my brain to quit spinning. But I don't pass a bathroom, so instead I find myself bursting through the front door so forcefully that the valet yelps in surprise. "Sorry," I stammer, moving toward the dark parking lot.
"Daphne,"
Miles calls, jogging after me.
"Daphne?"
I slow to a stop and try to seem and be as normal as possible.
"I'm okay," I say, facing him. "Just got a little dizzy."
"Shit." He comes closer, touches my waist as he hunches to peer into my eyes.
"You're probably dehydrated. Let's sit down and I'll get you some water."
I shake my head.
"No, it's fine. I think I should just head home."
"I'll get the keys from the valet,"
he says.
"No," I insist. "I'll grab a cab."
He studies me with the wary concern of a veterinarian examining a dog who just scarfed down a full espresso chocolate cake.
"If you're leaving, I am too."
Oh, right. Because while my brain was claustrophobically swirling with Miles, he hasn't forgotten that the love of his life is in there with another man.
"So you'll wait here?"
He ducks his head again.
"You won't run if I go get the keys?"
I shake my head. He lets go of my elbow and jogs back across the lot. By the time he gets back, I'm a little calmer. He opens my door for me first, then goes to get in the driver's seat, starting the engine.
"When did it start?"
"When did what start?" I say. Creases rise from the insides of his brows.
"The dizziness."
It takes a second to remember what he's talking about.
"Oh, just while we were dancing. I already feel a lot better."
He studies me for a long moment, then nods and backs out of the parking space. We drive in silence for several minutes, winding down the curve of the peninsula toward town, and I keep my eyes fixed out the window on the moon, watching it sparkle and vanish behind the tree line before popping back into view. The truck slows, drifting toward the dirt shoulder, and I face the windshield, expecting to find a deer blocking our way, but the road is empty, still. Miles puts the truck into park.
"Will you tell me what's going on, Daphne?"
he asks in a gravel.
"Nothing," I say.
"It's not nothing," he says. "Did something happen with Peter?"
"No," I insist.
"You can tell me,"
he says. But I can't. That claustrophobic feeling is back. Embarrassment and want mix together. I push open the truck door and stumble into the dark. Miles climbs out too.
"Where are you going?"
"I just need some air."
It's the simplest version of the truth. He rounds the hood of the car to stand in front of me.
"Did I do something?"
"No."
I've never been a good liar.
"Daphne,"
he says gently,
"please just tell me what I did."
And despite every intention of keeping all these feelings a secret until the end of the summer, I blurt,
"You kissed me."
His brow shoots up.
"I thought that was what you wanted. I thought that was what we were doing."
"No, I know."
I step back, my spine meeting the side of the bench seat.
"We were. It's different now."
"What do you mean?"
"I don't want to play that game anymore," I say. "I don't want you to say things you don't mean and do things you don't want to do. It's confusing."
"Who says I did anything I don't want to do?"
he asks.
"You did," I fire back. "You're the one who told me you don't want anything to happen between us."
"I never said that,"
he argues, stepping closer.
"And I don't want to be a prop to make your ex jealous, and I know I started it."
"You're not a prop,"
he says, looking hurt.
"That's exactly what I just was," I counter. "You only want to kiss me when they're there to see it, and I know I started it, but things are different now."
Miles's gaze drops on a hoarse laugh, a shake of his head. He steps in closer, our hips brushing. Then he looks back up, takes my face in both hands, and kisses me again. Rough, deep, messy, breathless, with no one to see it. Nothing to stop us. His hips pin mine back to the side of the passenger seat. His hands move around my back, spreading out over my bare spine, our chests pressing together, his heat cutting through the cold night.
"I want to kiss you,"
he murmurs, drawing back a mere inch.
"Every time you take a sip of something and make that sound."
I pull him back to me, that sound slipping from my mouth into his. My hands climb into his hair, his scrape down over my sides, his thigh pushing in between mine.
I want to kiss you every time I walk past your bedroom and hear your laugh through the door,
he says, and his hands steal beneath the hem of my dress all the way up to cradle my hips, my skin prickling like every cell wants to be a little bit closer to him. I untuck his shirt from his waistband. My hands skim up over his back, greedily touching every warm curve I can get to.
I want to kiss you every time I hear the shower turn on and know that you're in there,
he rasps. I touch his stomach, his chest, the muscles tightening as my fingertips brush over them, and he takes hold of my hips, lifting me up into the truck.
I want to kiss you all the time, Daphne,
he says.
Sometimes it's just easier to find an excuse.
I pull him closer by the belt loops, his hands grazing over my thighs as he pushes in between them. The curves of our bodies melt together. His parted lips run along my neckline. I scoot deeper into the truck, drawing him in after me, then climbing across his lap. His hands trace down my sides, his eyes dark.
Daphne,
he says, a throaty rumble. I reach back and undo the clasp at my neck, let the front of my dress fall to my waist. He groans, lightly cupping my breasts, lowering his mouth to lick me, then take me between his lips. I gasp, grip the back of his neck, my body arching into his.
What are we doing?
He murmurs against my skin. What do you want to do? I ask. A slow, testing thrust of his hips, the friction dividing my thoughts into fractals. His mouth drags back up my throat, his breath hot.
I want, he says raggedly, to undress you and taste you. I want to hear you come again and feel it too.
The fractals become fireworks, a kaleidoscope of sensations and needs. Miles' silky, dark hair between my fingers, his rough hands up under my dress, finding the lace of my underwear. The pressure of his warm mouth on my chest and the cool air kissing every other inch of exposed skin as the need and pleasure build together. Miles, I gasp, moving myself against him. His eyes slant up, his mouth still on me, his eyes nearly black. It's an unbearably sexy image.
Tell me to stop,
he says. I don't want you to stop, I pant out. I want to undress you. I want to taste you. I want to feel you come.
Fuck, Daphne.
He presses his forehead against my shoulder, his heart slamming into me, his hands braced lightly against my ribs, holding himself back from me. His low groan turns into a pained laugh. He straightens up, redoes the clasp behind my neck, and lets his hands slide down to my thighs.
I'm not good at this,
he says roughly. Good at what? I ask.
When things get complicated,
he scratches out.
I panic and shut down, and I don't want to do that right now. I can't.
My stomach sinks. It doesn't have to be complicated.
It already is,
he says. Because of Petra? I ask.
No,
he says, tenderly tucking a strand of hair behind my ear.
Not just that.
I slide out of his lap, blushing furiously.
Hey.
He reaches out, takes my hand. It's okay, I say quietly. You don't owe me any kind of explanation.
Daphne,
he says, his voice heartbreakingly soft. I look up and meet his eyes, all dark now, without any kind of glimmer.
There's a lot of shit I don't like to talk about.
His voice splinters.
The thing is, I have a bad habit of letting down the people I care about. I don't always think things through, and my feelings aren't something I can trust.
What is there to trust? I shake my head. You feel however you feel. He looks down at our hands, folds his fingers into mine. After several seconds, he clears his throat, but his face stays torqued, his eyes hyper-focused on our hands.
Growing up,
he hesitates for a long moment, visibly weighing his next words.
Our feelings, mine, Julia's, my dad's, those didn't matter much.
His jaw muscles flex as he swallows. His pulse speeds against my palm.
All that mattered was how it affected our mom, he says. If we made her look good, then she loved us. And if we didn't, then we were out to get her. Once I had a stomach bug, and she was so mad at me for throwing up in the night, said I was faking to get out of school, and if I kept pretending, I'd be grounded for a month. So I just went to class the next day, and every time I went to the bathroom, I threw up as quietly as I could, so the school wouldn't make her come get me. Whenever I did anything that she thought made her look bad, it turned into this huge thing about how I must hate her to try to hurt her like that. If I was upset or anxious or hungry or even sick, she acted like it was something I was doing to her, and I believed it.
Holy shit, Miles. I pull his hand into my lap, cup it between both of mine. He drags his eyes up to mine.
It's okay.
It's not, I say.
That's the thing, though, he scratches out. I need it to be okay. Because I need to be okay. As a kid, I just felt so fucking scared and powerless all the time. And now I just need to be okay.
He shakes his head.
I honestly think that's partly why Petra and I worked together. I've never met someone who was so in the moment. And that's where I have to be, because if I think too much about the past or the future, I come apart. So I mostly just keep all of that stuff where I don't have to think about it.
I drop my eyes. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to pry. His eyes come back to mine, his voice a scrape.
You're not, he says. I want you to know. I just...
What? He looks over my shoulder.
I don't want you to look at me like I'm broken.
Miles, I touch the sides of his neck and pull his gaze back to mine. You're not broken. You're okay. But what happened to you isn't. It's fucked up.
It's over,
he says quietly, his hands wringing my wrists. That doesn't mean you can't still have feelings about it, I tell him. The corners of his lips flutter for just a second.
That's the problem, though. Whenever any of us had a negative emotion, it only made things worse. She turned it around on us, and we'd end up apologizing for being hurt or angry or sad, and I never knew what was right or normal. I mean, everyone who met my mom loved her. Teachers, the other parents, my friends. If she wants to, she can make you feel like the center of the universe, like her favorite. I used to love having friends over because she'd turn into this different person, this funny, warm mom who loved me. All I wanted was for that version of her to stay. So I stopped showing it when I was upset, just went along with whatever she said and did. And eventually I just sort of stopped getting upset, stopped feeling the bad stuff, and things got better. For me, anyway.
He looks down, his eyes dark and glossed. I'm sorry, I whisper, running my thumb over the hinge of his jaw. I get why you didn't want to talk about it.
It's not just that. I mean, I do hate dwelling on this shit, but...
His Adam's apple bobs.
I let her really fucking hurt Julia. And when Julia's around, it's hard not to hate myself. All those feelings, they just come back. And my mind starts to feel so loud and dark. I just want to escape.
A dagger spears through my heart. I wrap my arms around him and burrow my face into his chest. I don't want to make him keep talking, but he is, like he's been uncorked and now it's all coming out. I picture it spiraling down a drain. Hope that's what this confession is doing for him, rather than scraping at an old wound.
She was way worse with Julia than she ever was with me. She'd compare Jules to our cousins, tell her who was prettier and smarter or better behaved. She'd compare Jules to herself at that age, shit that probably wasn't true.
His voice wavers.
She'd scream at her for the dumbest shit as long as I can remember. And I let it all happen.
I rear back. What were you supposed to do?
Stop her,
he says immediately, like he's thought this through, knows with certainty the right answer.
Stand up for Julia instead of shutting down. Not run away to the city the second I turned 18 and come back once a week like it made any fucking difference.
It did make a difference, I say, or she wouldn't be here right now.
Maybe. When he looks up at me, his eyes are stark, tired. But I don't even know why she's here because she won't tell me. No matter how hard I try, I always make the wrong decision. I fuck it up and people get hurt.
Miles. I grab his shoulders, turn his upper body toward me, and scoot in close, nearly into his lap. She got out.
On her own.
He shakes his head.
She saw through the shit way before I did. Chose an out-of-state college, and when our mom tried to tell her she couldn't go, she went anyway. Applied for her own loans, had me co-sign, moved to Wisconsin. Mom stopped talking to her to punish her, which completely backfired, so then she did her version of an apology. Sorry I wasn't perfect, but you'll understand when you're a mother someday. You can't do everything right, and your kids will hate you for it.
God, I say. I'm so sorry. Is that when you stopped talking to her?
He laughs coarsely. No. I wanted everything to be okay so badly. So I tried to broker peace. Just one more bad decision. My mom kept trying to pit me against Julia, and it didn't matter how many times I tried to set a boundary, she wouldn't stop. Wouldn't take any blame, won't say she's sorry or admit she did anything wrong. So eventually, I had to cut her off too.
And your dad's just okay with this? I say.
Not okay, Miles says. Just avoidant as fuck. Travels a lot for work.
So he left you guys to deal with all that on your own, I say. And you think you're the bad guy for finding a way to survive, for only going home once a week to spirit Julia away to a McDonald's?
His brows draw together. How do you know it was a McDonald's?
Because she told me, Miles, I say. She told me you rescued her and took her to a filthy play place and let her be an obnoxious kid and were completely unflappable no matter how terrible she was.
I'm not unflappable.
His voice takes on a damp gravel.
Honestly, it's hard to even look at her sometimes because it makes me think about everything I should have done differently, all the shit I try not to think about, and I just start feeling like I'm about to self-destruct.
You weren't the adult, I say.
I was what she had, he argues.
And you did what you could, I tell him.
That's the thing, though.
He shakes his head.
I don't know if I did. I don't trust my perception of things. That's what my childhood did to me, made my brain into a fucking funhouse where I might think I'm standing on the floor, but really I'm stuck to a wall. I never know if I'm feeling the right thing and I'm tired of fucking things up for the people I care about.
I don't think there's a right way to feel, I say. And you can't control it anyway. Feelings are like weather. They just happen and then they pass.
He rubs his face again. I'm sorry. This is why I don't talk about it.
Don't apologize.
I wrap my arms around his waist, and his eyes lift back to mine.
I'm your friend. I want to know all this. I want to be there for you.
I knew it was true, but when I say it, some crank inside my abdomen is slowly turning, pulling my heart tight against my chest. That's what Miles needs right now. A friend. And now I understand what he meant, how risky this really is, not just for me, but for him too. This isn't just a fun distraction or a rebound anymore. He matters to me, and if this thing between us blows up, there'll be nowhere for either of us to run right now.
You should talk to your sister about all of this, I tell him. Because I know you think you failed her, but from the outside, what I see is something's going on with your sister, and she got on a plane straight to you. Didn't even ask first, because she knew you'd make space. You're where she ran when she needed to feel safe.
Maybe she just didn't have anywhere else to go,
he murmurs. Maybe, I allow. But neither did I, and you took care of me too. That's who you are. If I had to be marooned, I'm glad it was with you.
Me too, he says quietly. Then, after a second, I don't want to fuck this up. Things are already a mess right now for both of us.
I don't want to mess it up either, I promise. This time, I mean it.
Not just because now I know him so much better, care so much more about this friendship, but also because I can admit what I couldn't before. I like Miles Nowak enough that he could really hurt me. So, he says, unsticking a strand of my hair from my eyebrow and tucking it behind my ear.
That was my complaint. What have you got?
Despite the ache in it, my heart flutters at this piece of evidence that he knows me, that I matter to him like he does to me. Are we playing whiny babies now? I ask. He nods.
Any grievances to air?
Well, I think for a beat. I'm not a huge fan of global warming. The corners of his eyes crinkle, my heart leaping in response.
I hear the Great Barrier Reef is in trouble,
he says. The wealth gap is ridiculous, I return.
And insurance is way too fucking expensive,
he adds. Not to mention, all day long, my sock kept getting caught under my heel, I say. He laughs a little, touches my chin. The moment feels like the meniscus of a glass, like any second it might spill over.
I guess we should go home.
I nod. His hand falls away.
Thank you,
he says. For what, I ask?
Just thank you.
20. Thursday, July 4th. 44 days until I could leave. If I still want to. Maybe things are complicated, but they're also good. Julia decides to stick around a bit longer, and the apartment is never empty, rarely quiet. Miles drops off chai for me at the library on his way into work. Ashley tells me about school drop-off drama over smoothies at a juice bar. One night, she, Julia, and I hit up Cherry Hill and watch Miles dazzle his customers at the bar's far end. Every time he looks over, it's like the sun peeking out from behind a cloud, and I do my best to feel content, to be just another person at the edge of his glow. On Thursday, he, Julia, and I go to Traverse City for the 4th of July parade, then sit in a row on grass so cool it feels damp to watch the fireworks pop and sparkle out over the bay. It's the kind of perfect summer night I can't remember having since I was a kid. Not even this time last year, when Peter and I went to his parents' annual barbecue. Because there, in their gorgeous, lightning bug-filled garden, with all of their longtime friends tipsy and flushed and happy in rattan patio chairs, a part of me had still ached. Could feel that I was standing outside of things, waiting for the moment I would finally become a part of it. Here, tonight, though, I'm in the center of everything. This moment, though fleeting, belongs to me too. On Sunday, we go back to Traverse City with Ashley for the end of the Cherry Festival. We wander the aisles of pop-up tents and food trucks, gorging ourselves on tarts and hand pies late into the night, and every time the Daphne moan sneaks out, Miles's eyes and mine seek each other out, the quirk of his mouth my own personal lightning rod. And then I look away. Because this is good. We are friends. When we can't stomach another bite, Julia demolishes us in a basketball carnival game, then talks us into riding the spinning cherries, from which we depart violently nauseous, cursing the cherry slushies we piled on top of everything else in our stomachs before boarding. I check for job postings occasionally, but only for jobs I really think I might like now. Other children's librarian or programmer positions in cities I'm at least interested in. Julia decides to stay another week, and we use our Sunday for an elaborate farmer's market shopping trip, followed by a visit to an arcade bar, where, once again, she heartily and gleefully annihilates us, this time at Ms. Pac-Man. Every night that week, we cook together. Or Miles cooks while Jules sits on the counter, curating a country playlist and singing along at top volume into whatever utensil her brother has most recently set down. I chop whatever he puts in front of me, wash whichever dishes he's done with. Most nights we eat on the floor around the coffee table, all the windows thrown open, the buzz of crickets and cicadas around us, and the smell of fur wafting in. But sometimes we sit in a row on the couch, eating while we watch a spy movie or one about a heist, my veins humming every time Miles leans across me to grab a handful of popcorn or the remote, my heart clenching whenever our eyes catch in the dark. Sometimes at night, from the other room, he texts me live updates as he listens to the audiobook of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Things like, I want to live with the beavers, and what is Turkish delight, and Edmund needs to chill. Sometimes we text for an hour straight, like our doors aren't 10 feet apart. We're basically always together, but we're almost never alone, aside from once when he accidentally locked his keys in the truck and I had to bring his spare up to the winery. I'm already in my pajamas, so he comes out to meet me in the lot with a grin and a hug that smells like campfire and feels like a hook in my heart. On Friday the 19th, I find out about the children's librarian job in Worcester County, Maryland. A quick online search tells me the Ocean City Library is 20 minutes from my mother and looks like an adorable lighthouse filled with books. I almost text my mom, but something holds me back. It seems too good to be true. There will probably be dozens of applications, and there's no point in getting my or her hopes up before I've even gotten an interview. Still, I email them my cover letter and resume on my lunch break and check my email obsessively for the rest of my shift. When I get home, I know Julia isn't there. I feel it like a barometric shift, probably because I typically hear Julia before I see her. Less clear is how my nervous system knows Miles is here, even though his Crocs aren't sitting next to the shoe rack, as is his custom, and it's Friday night when he usually works. I hang my bags on the hooks by the door, kick my loafers onto the rack, and round the corner into the kitchen. He's standing beside the stove, reading something on his phone with a divot between his brows as he waits for water to boil. "So you finally shut your sister in the pantry," I say. He looks up, breaking into a smile. "She's bringing up packages from the lobby." I lean back to peer out of the kitchen toward the living room. Three large cardboard boxes already sit stacked beside the coffee table. I feel a flurry of panic that I might have forgotten to cancel some expensive order for the wedding, and thus Peter has forwarded it here. A life-size marble statue of us embracing, maybe. No recollection of ordering that, but who knows? I was in a wedding fugue state. The water in the pot starts to burble, and Miles dumps hand-rolled trophée noodles into it. In the food processor beside him, I see what appears to be fresh-made pesto, and my salivary glands kick into high gear. "You hungry?" he asks. "I'm fine," I say. "You're drooling," he teases. "Is there enough?" I ask. "Of course," he says. "Don't you work tonight?" I call over my shoulder as I wander out of the kitchen toward the packages.
"Heading in right after this is done," he calls back.
I scan the mishmash of shipping labels and find the sender's name, Julia Nowak, an address in Chicago. Then the receiver's name, Julia Nowak, but with our address. I pad back into the kitchen. "What are all these boxes?"
"No idea," Miles says.
On cue, the front door flings open and Julia crashes into the room with more packages.
"Hey, Daph,"
she says, bustling past. I follow her into the living room, and she sets the boxes down with a huff.
"What you got there?" I ask.
She passes me on her way back to the kitchen.
"Just the essentials."
I peek my head back in as she's grabbing a sparkling water from the fridge.
"Essential what?" Miles asks.
She's already squeezing between us to leave the room again, her voice growing fainter as she retreats to the cardboard treasure trove at the far end of the apartment.
"Whatever I can't live without," she calls. "Paid my roommate to box it up. Once I find a place, I'll go back for the rest."
Miles's head snaps up from the pasta pot. Our eyes lock. He shakes his head, a general I have no idea pantomime. "It's okay," I say under my breath. He shakes his head, calls loud and clear.
"Jules, come here for a sec."
She pops her head back into the kitchen.
"Yeah?"
"Quick question," he says. "What the fuck are you talking about?"
With doe-eyed innocence, she asks, "What do you mean?"
"Why do you need more stuff?" he says. "Your stuff is already swallowing the apartment."
"I told you I was thinking about sticking around longer," she replies.
"Thinking about staying another week," he says. "That's what you said, a week ago."
"Exactly. I'm going to stay for another few days, then fly back to Chicago to pack up the rest of my stuff and drive it out here. But I needed my good clothes for job interviews, so I had Riley mail some stuff."
"Job interviews," he says.
"I'll need a new job," she says. "I can't live with you forever."
He runs a hand down his face.
"When did you decide all this?"
"When I got here and realized you were in total denial about what you've just been through and you obviously need me."
"Julia, I'm..."
"Fine," she finishes with an eye roll. "You're always fine."
"I'm going to just go in the other room," I say, creeping away.
"No, don't,"
Julia says cheerily, already backing toward the front door.
"Ashley is actually double parked downstairs waiting for me, so I have to run."
She whirls out the same way she whirled in. After a beat of silence, Miles and I look at each other.
"I'll get her a hotel," he says, "or I'll get you a hotel."
First of all, any hotel that will have a summer vacancy this last minute is not one I'm going to stay in, I say. And second of all, I can handle one more week of flat irons in the sink and bronzer on the floor. His brow lifts.
"You sure?"
"Positive," I say. "But how do you feel?" He clears his throat and turns back to the noodles, scooping one out with a fork to test it before carrying the pot to the strainer in the sink.
"I don't know," he says. "She's still acting like everything's normal, but I know my sister. She's hiding from something, and she doesn't usually hide."
"Maybe she really is just worried about you," I tell him. He dumps the noodles back into the pot.
"Why should she be worried about me?"
I stare at him.
"It was 3.5 months ago," he points out. "What does she need me to do to prove I'm okay? Get a tattoo that says happily single on my forehead?"
"That would scream I'm okay," I say.
"You know what I mean."
He dumps the pesto in with the noodles and swirls the pot around.
"I'm 13 years older than her. I've been on my own since she was a kid. I don't need my barely grown sister worrying about me, especially when worrying about me mostly just consists of leaving her dirty clothes on the hallway floor and setting her phone alarm to top volume, then snoozing it 500 times.
I get down a couple of bowls and some forks and pass them to him to start dishing it up. "Do you want me to kick her out?" He eyes me briefly, then goes back to scooping pasta into the bowls.
"I can't," he says. "Not when I don't know what's going on."
He adds a couple whole basil leaves to each bowl and passes me one. I set mine aside and touch his shoulders, ease them down. "If you ever need to vent," I say, "text me. You know I love complaining, and it's no fun to be the only one." His jaw softens. He sets his pasta aside too and pulls me into a hug that makes my bones liquefy, his breath warm against my neck. I close my eyes and breathe him in, and it's not complicated. I